On agenda this evening, we hear from Dawn Kinnish, who's taking her first bill through LegCo, and the interesting exchange in last week's House of Keys question time, in which it appeared that government's position is it doesn't want migrant workers to undercut Manx workers in the jobs market. Of course, that means that the minimum wage for Manx workers is lower than that for migrant workers. Here's the first part of the discussion in Keys that followed Laurie Hooper's question.
I'd like to ask the Minister for Enterprise whether the minimum wage will be increased to £13.05 an hour by the 1st of October 2025 to reach equivalence with the minimum salary threshold for worker migrant visas at that date.
As honourable members are aware, in bringing forward the most recent proposals in respect of the minimum wage, a commitment was made to review the current process for determining minimum wage proposals and the link with the living wage, reporting back to Timwald in July. That timetable remains on track, and I look forward to the debate at the July sitting. As such, it is not intended to bring proposals forward in respect to a specific minimum wage rate at this stage, and the Department will await the outcome of that debate before determining next steps. Thank you.
Okay, so the Minister is confirming then that from the 1st of October of 2025, it's the government's intention that a company employing a worker migrant on a visa will have to pay a higher minimum salary than if that same company employs a Manx person in the same job. I'd just like to confirm that is officially government policy as at this point in time.
Yeah, all I'm confirming is that I shall be bringing in July a report which will be laid to the Register of Business for debate for the Honourable Court of Timwald to decide and determine the forward of calculating the minimum wage.
Thank you.
Does the Minister believe that a two-tier minimum wage system is appropriate for the island, where Manx workers and workers that are entitled to be classified as Manx workers are actually entitled to a lower statutory minimum wage than workers that we import from other jurisdictions? And does he not see that the risk here is that he may be creating a subclass of workers, where Manx workers are the ones employed in low-income jobs, because actually companies can legally get away with doing that under his two-tier minimum wage system?
As confirmed by the Cabinet Office Minister in this update to Timwald last month, he confirmed on behalf of the Treasury Minister that the intention was to increase the absolute minimum salary permissible in the immigration rules. Yes. Statements of changes to the immigration rules are therefore a matter for Treasury. I think it's important to separate the legal minimum wage and salary thresholds in place for immigration purposes, as they serve different purposes. I understand it has long been the case that salary levels, including an absolute minimum, have been set within the immigration rules, whereas they are not set for any purpose for local workers other than the legal minimum wage. Whilst it's ultimately a matter for Treasury to bring forward immigration proposals, I do understand the rationale for seeking to increase the absolute minimum, essentially because the current figure has not been updated for some time. The proposal therefore seeks to correct this. It is also important to recognise that workers who do not fall under immigration control can move more freely around the labour market, whether this is in the Isle of Man or the UK. Those workers requiring a visa do not have the same flexibility or choice, so ensuring their level of pay is reasonable is of greater importance to avoid the risk of exploitation. Visa holders also have no recourse to public funds in the majority of cases. Thank you.
I'd like to thank the Minister there for saying the quiet part out loud. He thinks that it is essential that workers on a visa are protected from the risk of exploitation, and the way the government achieves this is by ensuring they are paid a living wage. Does he not believe that Manx workers are entitled to the same rights and protections?
I fully accept the fact that it's absolutely right that we have a statutory minimum for minimum wage, and that is exactly what we have. It is common practice that for the minimum immigration rates are often different. Look at the UK, it's now, I think, at something like £38,000. What we have to do is look at our economy, our island, and that's a commitment that's been made by the last month in a statement by the Cabinet Office Minister. There will be further proposals coming forward, I believe, in July on that. It's a work in progress, but I must stress that it's got nothing to do whatsoever with the minimum wage. And as I say, I will be bringing that debate to the Honourable Court of Timwald in July. Thank you.
Will the Minister confer with other Ministers, because we're hearing that one department does this, another department does that. It is actually an Isle of Man government solution that we're looking for here, rather than siloed decision making with departments. And will he also agree that any changes to the minimum wage of either can be a transitional one for those that are already here?
All I would say is, as I say, when it comes to the determination of the statutory minimum wage, that is a process in itself, and the decisions around what the minimum should be for those coming through the immigration system is a separate issue that is discussed separately from my department. So I can't conflate the two. As I say, we will be bringing forward the proposals in July. It will be then I think there'll be further discussions as far as the future plans are for incentives and disincentives on immigration. The Cabinet Office Minister has made a commitment to bring further details forward in that, and I await that statement and that debate. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'm quite appalled, actually, of what I've heard come out of the Minister's mouth this morning, greater importance on immigration, people that are immigrating to our island to be paid a higher pay than local people. Can the Minister please circulate the business case for the immigration rules and also the calculation and how they come to the decision to keep it, actually, I think, too low, because we're encouraging low-paid immigration into the Isle of Man in the first place. So can he please commit to circulate that business case, circulate the calculation for that immigration rate, and also please correct that there's a greater importance on that immigration rate than our local people working hard in our economy.
The issue of minimum wage, and it's prescribed in the minimum wage legislation, and the absolute minimum salary threshold set on the immigration rules are entirely separate matters. It is a well-established position in the Isle of Man rules, and indeed of those of the UK, that salary rates are prescribed both for specific employments and to establish an absolute minimum salary. Many salaries are well above minimum wage levels, as indeed was the absolute minimum salary prescribed in immigration rules when it was set in 2018. And it was that point that was made by the Cabinet Office Minister in his statement last month at Timbald, where he recognised the fact that that level hasn't been increased since 2018. It had fallen behind minimum wage levels, and it was right that it was adjusted. There's no change to the general position. All that is being proposed is that there is an interim increase to the absolute salary payable whilst broader work is progressed on the island's immigration routes. Thank you.
Dr. Allinson.
Would the Minister agree with me that the increase in the minimum required salary is benchmarked against the living wage, but the legislation currently in our country is that everyone must be paid a minimum wage? What the policy is trying to do is, as honourable members have said, make absolutely certain that those people who are being invited to move to our country to take up jobs here are paid an adequate wage, but at the same time are not seen to be undercutting workers who are already here. Thank you.
Minister to reply.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Yes, I fully agree with that statement. Thank you.
That was part of the discussion in Keys that followed Laurie Hooper's question. Why did Mr. Hooper raise this?
I brought a motion back in 2017, I think it was, saying we should have a living wage on the island. That's where all this kind of started. We should have a living wage. So for 8 years or so, I've been pushing this to make sure that people who go out and do a full day's work actually can pay the bills and participate in island life, and they don't have to rely on the benefit system. Government isn't there yet. We're still behind. But government, as part of the island plan, promised that we would get there. We would have a living wage as the minimum wage by, they said April 2025. Tim will ask for it by 2026, but they said April 25. The government then kind of changed their mind on that, and they said, well, we'll go up a bit this year, but we're not sure about the second uplift in October, so we're going to put that on hold. I wasn't a big fan of that. I gave them the opportunity to change their minds. Tim Wall didn't agree with me. That's Tim Wall's prerogative. So what it means is we now have a minimum wage on the island that is lower than the living wage, but is higher than it was. So, you know, we're getting there. And then, I think it was a month or two ago in Tim Wall, the government brings an amendment to the immigration rules that says, okay, but actually from the 1st of October, anyone moving to the island under a visa was going to need to be paid at least the living wage. So they've decided that we're not doing this for Manx workers because it's too difficult for businesses to pay, but we are going to do this for any foreigners coming here on a visa. That feels quite unfair to me. I think everyone should be paid a living wage, and I think you don't want to have a lower visa requirement than a minimum wage because you don't want to have people being undercut. But equally, what you don't want to do is tell people you can employ one person or another in this job, but if you employ a Manx person, it's going to be cheaper because you can pay them less. I don't think that's fair at all. So that's why I asked the government, what are you doing? Are you actually going to align the living wage for everybody with this new requirement, or are you going to create a two-tier system? And the answer was, they don't think they're connected at all. They're happy with a two-tier approach.
The Treasury Minister intervened in the question and answer session, and normally when ministers intervene it is to back up their colleagues. But effectively, I think the Treasury Minister pretty much said this, what we don't want is people coming into the Isle of Man undercutting Manx workers.
He did say that, and actually if you're paying everybody a living wage as a minimum, that should never happen. But the only reason that we have people being undercut now is because Manx workers can be paid less than people that you're bringing in on a visa. Both are legal minimum salary requirements, that they are minimum wages essentially, and they just apply to different people. So if you're saying, no, we think it's okay that a business can pay a Manx person less, that's bizarre. That is absolutely bizarre. I don't understand the logic behind that. And that's what the government are saying, because they are not putting up the minimum wage to the living wage. They're still quibbling over, well, how do we calculate the living wage? Is it still right? Is it fair? But they've used that number for the visa system. So they've said that number is good enough for anybody on a visa, but it's not good enough for the rest of us. That makes no sense. There is no logic behind this position at all. And ultimately, those that lose out will be people in low-paid jobs, because that will essentially become the preserve of Manx workers, because a company can't employ somebody on a low-wage job from off-island. So they will start saying, well, actually, I can only employ Manx people in these jobs unless I want to put the wages up. And, you know, how many companies voluntarily put wages up when they have other options available to them? And that's the problem we're dealing with here, I think. If we had a really vibrant employment market where actually there was lots of unemployment, lots of people that could get trained and all the rest of it, we don't have lots of people competing for jobs because there aren't enough people. There's lots of people already in work. We don't have lots of unemployment here that gives people a bit of a opportunity there. So you've already got businesses saying, I can't recruit people into these posts. So are they really going to say, I'm going to promote internally, I'm going to promote Manx workers to higher paid jobs, when I know I can't fill that vacancy with someone new to the industry? I'm going to have to pay somebody more either way. Who am I going to give the higher paid job to? Is it someone that I have to pay more anyway, or is it someone that I could get away with paying less? Well, you're going to say, well, I'm going to have to pay the person more anyway, so I may as well go down that route. Logically, I don't think any of this stacks up. And the minister intervening and saying it was all about not being undercut, and the message being it's fine to undercut by paying Manx workers less, coming from the government, I just was blown away by that.
And some of this, of course, is because it's different departments with different rules and different situations. So, for example, there is a minimum wage committee, and that minimum wage committee considers certain things. I guess the people deciding on the immigration rules will have different views. Differences, though, are something that the council ministers are there for.
Well, that's a misdirect, actually, because the Minimum Wage Committee makes a recommendation to the Department for Enterprise and Treasury, and they have to jointly agree a minimum wage, and it's Treasury that decides the immigration. So actually, it's the Treasury. They're involved in all these things. And so I would accept that if it was two departments that were completely disconnected. But it's the same people involved in the same decisions for the same purposes. So this isn't one of those times where government can say, oh, sorry, no, we just didn't talk to each other. No, it's the same people involved in all these decisions and making different decisions for different reasons, even though the impact is going to be the same. And so ordinarily, I'd agree with you, Phil. Government left hand, right hand, not talking to each other could be a reason this is happening. That isn't why this is happening, because it all comes back to the Treasury. They're involved in all these decisions. They should know what they're doing.
On to other items. And you have a motion down on the order paper for Tynwald in relation to the assessments of the schools. Now, I guess there'll be lobbying taking place. You will be aware that many head teachers are concerned at publishing all the details of all the assessments of their schools. How do you respond to that?
So I haven't actually been heavily lobbied by anyone other than parents concerned about not being able to understand what's going on in the schools. I actually would agree with the view that says you probably don't want to publish everything if it's a really heavily detailed assessment. And the problem is I have no idea what's in those reports, because the department hasn't seen fit to share them with anyone. Teachers haven't even seen these reports in most cases. So I don't really know what is in them in order to have a sensible conversation. The department is saying, oh, trust us. It's hard to trust a department that refuses to tell you anything. But when they commissioned these reports, they should have commissioned the work with an expectation that stakeholders like parents, like teachers, like students, like politicians would want to be able to reassure themselves that everything's going okay, that we've got some understanding of this. And it's clear they didn't do that. It's clear that what has transpired now is that we understand they have produced a really detailed report for the management of schools, and they've produced a half a side of A5 for parents that is meaningless waffle. And nothing in between. And that's the problem. When they commissioned the work, they should have been very clear that we're not going to publish teachers' names and classroom numbers and all. That's not what anyone's interested in. But we are going to publish a sort of a summary assessment. And if you look at jurisdictions like Scotland and Wales, which take a similar approach, they've published parent information leaflets, but they also publish what they call summary information reports. And what they do is they take the really detailed stuff and they actually pass that and they put it in a format that is understandable to parents, that's understandable to lay people like myself, not educationalists. And it's got enough information in that you can read it and get a real understanding of how the school sees itself as doing and how the validators have gone in to see, actually, we think the school's spot on with some of this stuff. What we have here is we're missing that information. And if that information existed, that's what I'd be asking for. That is exactly what I'd be asking the department for. Because all I'm interested in here is getting better information out there for parents, for those teachers that have gone through this process, and for students who might be interested in, you know, in the performance of the school. And if that's where the department had been, if they'd been engaging with me on this, if they'd have turned around and said, actually, we're quite happy to figure out how to do that, I wouldn't have tabled this motion. But so far, what we've had from the department is no, no, no. And that's not particularly helpful. So what I'm hoping, actually, is that I know there's going to be a briefing again this week now from the department. I'm hoping the minister will have managed to talk to her colleagues and will come out with a solution that says, actually, we are going to improve the way we deliver information to parents, in which case I don't need to move the motion. I will have achieved what I'm seeking to achieve, which is to get the department to understand that what they are producing at the moment is not helpful or meaningful for anybody. It may be great if you're an educational specialist, but for the rest of us, it doesn't tell us anything about what's going on in schools. And it's important to know that what's going on there. It's important to know that the department has a handle on the good, the bad, and the ugly. And if I'm perfectly honest, Phil, my view on this is the schools over here, by and large, do a really good job. Actually, I would be very surprised if these reports don't, for 95% of the stuff, show our schools in a very good light. And it's a bit concerning for me that actually the department isn't shouting about that as well. If these reports have said, look, mostly you guys are doing great. There's a few issues on the bottom end, a few things we need to fix. But by and large, you're doing great. And if that's what the reports show us, why is the department not shouting from the rooftops? Because I'd be amazed if they show us anything more fundamentally wrong. You know, by and large, schools do pretty good. Let's tell people that. Let's have that message. Let's have that conversation. But it's very hard to do that when the department is shutting down and refusing to engage.
And I guess we don't want to have a situation where a particular school in a particular part of the island is doing particularly well, and then all the parents, prospective parents, decide that they're going to move house so that they can send their kids to that school. And it does happen already to a certain extent in the island.
I think that happens anyway. I think people, there are some schools over here that are well known for having larger out-of-catchment populations. It's just the way it is. I don't think you're ever going to stop that, actually. But what I suspect these reports will show is some of the schools that you may not immediately associate with being quite good performing, quite high performing schools. I think people will be surprised, actually. I've spent a few years in the education department. I've been around most of our schools, and sometimes the schools that you think are going to have bigger challenges, actually, they still perform really well. And so it'll be interesting, and this is one of the reasons I'm interested in seeing this stuff, is to get a better understanding of actually where are resources being invested and where should we be helping more, what aspects of the system needs more help, what aspects of the system are doing really well and we should be celebrating. But again, it's really hard to do that when the department is really giving you nothing to work with. And from my perspective, it is all about building that confidence in school communities, building confidence in the department's ability to oversee the schools. And that's kind of where the gap is at the moment. I think if you're talking to, and from the head teachers that I have talked to, they're quite open about what's going on. They're quite happy to talk to people about things. And I don't really see it as at that level being an issue. I mean, some of the schools have published their own self-assessments already on their websites. So actually, the information for some schools is out there already. It feels to me more like this is a departmental issue of not being willing or able, perhaps, to articulate these reports in a way that gives people a true picture of what's going on, but also protects kind of the anonymity and the small community issues that you always get when you're inspecting. If you look at the health reports that we did, for example, from the CQC, they were published in full. And it's the same issue there. We've got some small practices, small teams. But that was all handled in a way that didn't draw out some of those issues in a way that would cause issues. And I don't really understand why the department isn't able to do that with the schools too. And I suspect it comes down to the way they've commissioned these reports and the way this work was commissioned in the first instance by the department.
That was Ramsay MHK Laurie Hooper, Finally, Dawn Kinnish MLC moved the principal stage of the Local Government Amendment Bill 2023 in last week's sitting of the Legislative Council.
It's been a long time coming. As you know, it came from a Tynwald Select Committee on local authorities and members' interests, so that's what's driven a lot of the change forward. And, you know, I think it's timely that we do revisit conflicts of interests and registrable interests. So, you know, much of what is in the bill is around that, and that's where it originated from.
I think you described the bill as bringing in a greater degree of transparency for ratepayers. How does it, how would it do that? I mean, obviously it's not passed yet, so it may not do this, but how could the bill achieve that?
Well, I've just mentioned about interests, and so a register of interests needs to be kept by the local authority, but the intention is that that is for public access, so that allows much more openness and transparency with the bill. But there's other areas as well, you know, access to documents within the meetings held by local authorities. So, you know, it just gives that further level of transparency and openness, which, you know, is very much what people, the public, demand these days.
One of your colleagues, Mr. Crane, mentioned the vast difference in size between some of the authorities. Obviously, Douglas is by far and away the largest authority, with tens of thousands of people that it looks after. And then you have some local authorities with just a few hundred. Is that something that the department is looking at the moment, or is the bill just accepting that the current structure is as it should be, and we just work with it?
There's no hidden agenda, if that's what you mean about local authority reform. You know, we've seen reform. You know, Garth is a really good example of where different authorities have come together, and I think, you know, going forward, the demands on local authorities when it comes to compliance is immense, you know, the specialism that's required in relation to that. So you can see the advantages for them to do that voluntarily, and that's where Garth led a good example of that. But no, there's no agenda from the department to force some form of local authority reform.
And there is an amendment to the bill, effectively calling for an evidence stage. Is the department comfortable with that?
Well, it's not really in the department's gift. This is part of the parliamentary process. Legislative Council had it in their gift to call for an evidence stage. You know, members have been lobbied hard, and therefore the opportunity will arise now for local authorities to come and give that evidence in order for members to consider that in the passage of this bill.
And that is specifically about an issue that arose in the House of Keys, where Laurie Hooper amended the bill, and the local authorities felt that amendment needed further consideration. Is that effectively, that's what this is, the evidence stage is about. But I'm not sure whether the clarification of the clerk in the debate actually suggested that the evidence stage, once you take an evidence stage, it can be as wide as members choose.
Absolutely, it doesn't, you know, obviously the members have been lobbied around a specific part, clause 5 of the bill, but yeah, we can take evidence now on any aspect of the bill. You know, my colleague Mr. Mercer raised issues around conflict of interest, so, you know, we could take evidence in relation to that. So it doesn't have to be narrow focused, it can be on any element of the bill.
How does it feel being the effectively the sponsor of a bill? I mean, you've worked in various guises in relation to the law. This is the first time you're actually responsible for making a piece of law, and it really is your responsibility, this one.
Yeah, actually it feels quite exciting, I think, because I've had a legal background. You know, normally as a lawyer, yeah, you might see consultations and comment on those, but you're at the back end of the law, you're interpreting the law once it's been passed. So it is quite exciting to be at the beginning of that journey and have input into that and deliver something that, you know, lots of my learned colleagues across the Isle of Man would then have to apply and interpret.
And what's different, I suppose, in terms of creating law as opposed to interpreting it?
Well, it's particularly from the viewpoint of Legislative Council, it's about making sure that you don't miss unintended consequences. It's making sure that it achieves what it is meant to achieve, and that's quite difficult because, you know, language can be interpreted in so many different ways. So it's having that open viewpoint. And I think, you know, thinking about my colleagues, that's the advantage of the diversity of membership on council, is we all look at things through a different lens, whether that's been through our professional lives or our personal lives, but we will approach it from a different angle, and that, you know, has great benefit to the outcome of legislation.
And in terms of prepping for something like this, I mean, how many times, for example, have you read the bill, and how do you go about prepping for something like this?
Well, I'll read the bill as many times as I need to. So, you know, you can have a very simple clause that doesn't cause you any concern, but then there may be other clauses that you have to cross-reference with other legislation or cross-reference with other clauses, and it can take a little while to understand that. But we do have the support of a drafter, legislative drafter. We have the support of legislative officers. So it's not a journey on your own. You know, I do have some background knowledge, but it's important to pull in everybody with the expertise. And, you know, some of these officers have been working on this bill for a very long time now, so know this bill inside out.
That was DOI member Dawn Kinnish, MLC. So what do you think? Would you like to see greater transparency across local government? Do you feel local government is still effective? And is it reasonable to pay Manx workers less than those coming to the island with migrant worker visas? Let me know what you think by contacting Phil Gorn at manxradio.com and get in touch if you have any ideas for future shows. Don't forget, this programme is available as a podcast on Manx Radio's website. For now, I'm Phil Gorn. Go to Mayo. Thanks for listening.